Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's summer season here on autonomousmedia.net. Yes, we're back live on the last Thursday of the month whilst we run a bit of an experiment in magazine radio, the first episode of which is actually happening right now. We kicked off with Sheila Nagig and Monster Stomp, bit of a gentle tune, I thought, really like that one. Bit of a warm-up. They, of course, are a Fire in the Mountain band. Fire in the Mountain, only a month or so away now, first weekend in June, so tickets will be well on sale. It's looking like it's going to be a really great event this year. And that was followed by Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra, another Fire in the Mountain band, and Great Fire of Biker. There ain't no scrapyards in old Biker Town. There's Burnt Down. We've got really much limited access to our scrap yards now, or recycling yards as they're called nowadays, because unilaterally our mighty council, well not actually unilaterally, across Cymru the rules have been changed such that scrap yards that used to be open 7 days a week and especially on bank holidays are now only open 3 days a week and not on bank holidays. In addition to that, you're no longer allowed to take even a small van into the place, like a little Transit Connect van. You're no longer allowed to take in double-axle trailers. You're no longer allowed to take in crew cabs, because all of these things are now defined as commercial. And therefore, if you want to take that into the recycling yard, you basically got to get yourself, gather not one, but two licenses for one visit a month. This is already causing a lot of people a lot of distress, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I can only think that they're probably going to make a lot more money from fining people for fly tipping than they are from running their free dumps or something like that. Or maybe I'm being entirely cynical. A private eye recently ran an article about a man who had several tons of shredded plastic dropped onto his land. And as a result of it being private land, nominally, of course, as we understand, it was his job to tidy it up and the council would have nothing to do with it. So he ended up with a bill for £6,000 to tidy up land for something that really the council should have been taking care of. And also, what we realised is that all of these things that I just listed used to be allowable and therefore used to be free. And now they're not. And yet the bills being charged by the council are going up and up and up. And it really makes you wonder, doesn't it? How many other people would we accept that kind of service from? Not many, I suspect. So that was Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra, Great Fire Biker. After that, Slade, The Shape of Things to Come. Nothing can change the shape of things to come, they say, but later on in the show, we'll be dipping into the holographic paradigm with an excerpt from Michael Talbot's book on that subject, and we'll be looking at the candle and the laser and discovering, in fact, that far from not being able to shape not being able to change the shape of things to come, we might actually be directly responsible for them. So changing them all the time we are. And that was followed, of course, by Motorhead and I Love Rock and Roll, which was just to reassure you that things haven't changed whilst I've been away getting myself grubby in the polytunnel. And there will be more Motorhead later. So the idea here is I've been trying to make it so that the radio show is a little easier to get together, a little better integrated with what I'm doing in my everyday life, and therefore a more comfortable, varied experience for everybody. In the early days, Dr. Rock's show was very much a magazine show. We had a mixture of live chat and pre-recorded interviews done at festivals. And I used to play little podcasts that I'd heard that I thought were short enough and would make a big difference if people heard them, because I called them in my mind killer pods. And I figure that even a two-hour show with one guest, it's quite hard on the guest, must be hard on the listener. It's quite a lot of fun, I must admit, as an interviewer, because it does enable you to go in some depth into things. But I'm pretty sure we'll still have live guests on the show, probably normally between 9 and 10 for an hour or so. And the idea is we'll be fitting other stuff around them, which will be a mixture of readings and recorded interviews. And thoughts arising, as it were, because there are a lot of them nowadays. It's a rich variety of material that could make it to the show. And I'm hoping that by making it a bit more of a kind of a lock and load thing, that I can record things, get a bit of stuff behind me and make it all a lot easier. So the blog for tonight's show, which is the first experiment in this, is it says this Thursday we will be considering the LEADER programme, which is running in every county in Cymru, and claims to use local knowledge to promote a joined-up, grassroots, community-led delivery of rural development. Yes, you heard me right. It claims to use local knowledge to promote a joined-up, grassroots, community-led delivery of rural development. Straight away, we know, do we not, that we are in the realm of newspeak and that we are no longer listening to normal people. I heard Mark Windows really quite a long time ago now talking about change agents. We've obviously known about common purpose and all manner of other things that are designed socially to engineer a new world around us using us as the raw material. I'm sad to say that it seems now to be absolutely everywhere. Once, like everything else, once you open your eyes to it, and especially once you start just grotting a little bit under the surface, which is what I'll be doing tonight, you start finding that what's actually going on is really quite mad and maddening as well. So at the moment, it would appear that rural development, in this case, the rural development strategy, means adding value to local identity and natural and cultural resources. And for adding value to, we should read making money from. To add value to something is to capitalise upon it. So right from the word go, we gather that this rural development strategy is aiming to capitalise upon local identity and natural and cultural resources. This is a statement it makes quite plainly in their guide notes, and it's quite apparent once you realise that's what's going on, that that is what's happening as well, as we shall hear. As the months go by, I think, because we're getting very close to this, you can barely avoid it round here, unfortunately. Their other aims are to facilitate pre-commercial development, business partnerships, and short supply chains. We could probably drop the supply and just say short chains, couldn't we? Because that's really what's happening. They also wish to explore new ways of providing non-statutory local services, and we'll hear a bit more about them in the next show, when we look at the local funding for all of this thing. Non-statutory local services are themselves a right can of worms. And they also seek to exploit digital technology. And I'm assuming that they, by exploiting digital technology, they mean getting everybody to put their stuff onto the web, where it is, of course, in the public and therefore no longer safe and private. So really, the change agents are among us. We've got weasel words, they've got strange aims, and far from grassroots attitudes, I'd say. It is not grassroots community-led delivery. Grassroots community-led delivery is what happens when people freely organise themselves to do the things that they want and need to do, not when somebody else provides vast wads of cash in exchange for duties and responsibilities for dictating how it is that you're going to run your thing. So that's where I'm going to kick off for the first hour of the show. There's some really hairy, it's because the words are so important. You've been playing a song by Chumbawamba recently called Enough is Enough. Where have all the anti-fascists gone is where one of the lines in there. And I was recently listening to James Corbett, as I do quite a lot on the interweb. And he pointed out that what used to be called the left, whatever that means, has been suborned by newspeak, by the change in the language. And it sounds like a pretty strange idea, but again, round here, and we've talked about it a lot over the years, I think, with the transition towns and One Planet Development and all manner of other things, that guidelines are kind of really invading our lives and becoming not guidelines, in fact, they're becoming a sort of unofficial legislation by which everything is run. And by looking carefully at their documents, and what I do with them nowadays is I go in there and I try to remove all the stuff that isn't the core of a sentence and just leave me with their bald statements, which is what I've been doing with this this local development strategy. All themselves rather dodgy words. But later on in the show, we'll also be having a listen to a TruthStream Media pod about the fact that United Airlines invited federal policy enforcement officers basically onto a plane to assault and bloody a paying passenger. Truly hairy 10 minutes of vid, but the TruthStream Media people have done a really cracking job at tidying it up and bringing to the fore many, many major things about this little 10-minute YouTube that are, I think, worth putting out there on the radio show and, you know, as a podcast. We'll also later, as I said, be having a look at some of Michael Talbot's work on the holographic universe and a return to the dream time, which is really great because it's a bit of a balance to this nightmare guide notes we're going to be looking at. And we'll be hearing a poem from Will Watson. It's called Housing Crisis, so it's a little reading from the Dark Mountain Press. And there will, before the end of the show, be news from the polytunnels, which is they're the reason really why I, not only have I not been doing my radio show, I have barely been seen on the internet. So apologies to all my fellow hosts for not being in the chat box and to all you guys. But towards the end of the show, you'll get to see what I've been doing instead. And all will return to normal, I'm sure, later in the year, probably around the autumn. We're planning on this monthly show for the next 6 months or so, and by then we should all be wound up and ready to roll weekly for a three-hour show, and it should be pretty stress-free. So there we go, Dr. Rock's Summer Season, a new radio magazine from the people who brought you Dr. Rock's radio show. And first up, the abuse of language, people, and I'd say potentially our environment, which is being represented by a set of rural development policy guide notes that I've recently been perusing. Astute listeners will know that I've dipped into several of these guide notes in the recent past because having read one lot and found out how to extract the core information out, because there's a lot of fluff in these things. I mean, all the language is fluff as well, but around the fluff is extra fluff, I think, to keep you from noticing what's going on. So I've been filleting the 40 pages or so of this particular strategy document, and I've removed subclauses, all the stuff in brackets and all the stuff between commas, and I've taken out irrelevances and other miscellaneous distractions so that we might cut to the chase pretty quickly. And it's summarised now into a tidy 5 pages or so from 40, which I think is pretty impressive. But it's all right, folks, we ain't going to do all of that. We ain't going to have the time. But I think this is going to make you chuckle and spit in basically more or less equal proportions. In its way, actually, you know, this game, it's a lot more fun than Bugs Bunny, and I'm pretty much a loony as well. Oh, hi there, Paul. Mr. Cotty in the house. Not Mr. Cotty. Paul Cotty in the house. Nice to see you, mate. So, this particular set of guide notes, you know, I spent some time actually talking to Paul about the One Planet development. We did two or three shows on what was an 85-page guiding document, which is basically enforceable policy by some means or another. But this particular one is as usual, a screed of entire nonsense. But it attracted my attention because it really does appear that I'm going to be getting up close with a substantial project to which these guidelines most assuredly apply. Close, that is, but most definitely not personal. Lucky old me, eh? It's going to be quite interesting to watch what happens, because I don't think anybody that applied for the funding or anybody that's applying for the jobs has actually read the rural development strategy, and they probably haven't read the Arwine funding strategy, which is what runs the whole thing. And you wait till you hear some. This is completely outrageous. It is anyway. So some people that I know are close to taking a substantial cloud of gaming tokens in exchange for undertaking a feasibility study. And the structure of this feasibility study and the project is primarily defined by the rural development strategy. But it's actually executed on the ground by things called local action groups, which are also known as LAGs, which I find these people maybe don't have a sense of irony or something. But LAG is definitely what this sort of thing introduces to the system, because what we're talking about is instead of people freely organising themselves and using their resources to do what needs to be done, there's somebody trying to legislate such a scheme into existence and crop the data, really, and eventually, if you ask me, they're aiming to crop any good ideas that come up and basically have them away. So, the beginning of it, Arwine will be looking at next month. It's called a LEADER scheme, and for some reason, LEADER is LEADER, all in capital letters. I haven't quite managed to track down what it stands for, but it definitely stands for something. It's the LEADER scheme for Powys. Powys is a unitary authority made up of three old counties, and there's one of these running everywhere in Wales, and I suspect everywhere in UK PLC. The LAG for Powys is called One Powys Local Action Group, which is OPLAG. And doesn't that sound like something out of 1984? OPLAG, yeah. And apart from being filleted of all the nonsense, it's otherwise as written. So I've kept the sentence structure. I've kept pretty much the words that they use and stuff so that we don't lose any of the quality of it. So these guidance notes, this gives you the first clue as to what goes on straight away, what goes on immediately, apart from this really slippery words they use, is the obfuscation of who's responsible for what. And you just imagine each time you introduce another of these groups and another of these policy documents, you've introduced an impossible level of complexity. So the guidance notes for leader local action groups complement the local development strategy. Actually, the leader local action groups serve the local development strategy, as we shall hear. They complement the local strategy guidance document by explaining eligible activities and expenditure and how the local action groups will manage development in their areas. Local action groups will manage development in their areas. And we know development is a very suspect word. Makes everybody nervous when you ask just exactly what they mean. A bit like sustainability, really. It's a word that pops up all over the place. Can't really be explained, I don't think. So its main aims, and I'll cut to the chase, so we've leapt straight to Article 21, really, of the document. But so it's got a set of main aims, which in themselves, you know, they would have been a little bit better disguised, I think, in the old days. But obviously, these guys are feeling pretty upfront about what they're doing. And again, you'll realise that what we're looking at here, we're talking about social enterprise, but we're looking at entirely commercial language, I think you'll agree. Especially when number 21 kicks off, it says, under Article 5 of Commission Regulation 1305/2013, 18 focus areas have been identified under each of the 6 priorities identified for rural development. Okay, so we've got 18 focus areas for 6 different priorities that are designed to bring about rural development, whatever that means. First of these is to foster knowledge transfer and innovation in agriculture, forestry and rural areas. Well, you know what the doctor and Synchro think about agriculture, forestry and rural areas. We think it's totally destroying the countryside, all the wildflowers, all the insects, all the birds and all the trees. That's what we think it's doing, and we think it's resulting in sheep. So fostering knowledge transfer and innovation doesn't look very likely. But what they do want to do is see what happens when we try to do that sort of thing, so that any potentially profitable or useful developments can then be harvested, I guess. They also wish to enhance competitiveness of all types of agriculture and enhance farm viability. Well, once again, I've just gone on and on and on about the fact that farms aren't making any money. You know, the milk's going down even lower, below the cost of production. Most small farms in Cymru are only earning about £30,000 a year after subsidies. And you could pretty much earn that as a supervisor in Aldi's. You know, you wouldn't have to be running a farm and out there in all weather. So, again, enhancing farm viability. This is a statement of this really high up on the list of statements of intent. But it really, I think it's got to be a case of by their deeds shall ye know them, hasn't it? It's just been non-stop degradation of the environment, the natural landscape, and of the small farms, which in their ideal form would, of course, be supporting the environment from which they're extracting wealth. That's not what these guys are after doing. They're just after extracting the wealth, I suspect. They want to promote food chain organisation and risk management in agriculture. I'm not even going to go there, but you can see where, you see this. This is nonsense. This one, this is great. Catch this one, everybody. Listen carefully. They wish to restore, preserve and enhance ecosystems dependent on agriculture. Restore, preserve and enhance ecosystems dependent on agriculture. So restoring, preserving and enhancing are not at all the same thing. And we've been into that before as well, about whether actually having a wildlife reserve in which you allow sheep to graze is in any way a wildlife reserve, and various other things. Enhancing ecosystems is to even imply that we can enhance ecosystems is, I think, hubris and a little cocky, to say the least. And And these ecosystems that they want to restore, preserve and enhance are apparently dependent on agriculture. Pah! That is just so obviously some kind of logical fallacy. None of those ecosystems are dependent on agriculture, except in as far as they're being trashed. But we do know that if we build a wall or a fence around a large area, then it pretty quickly starts setting about becoming the other thing. So to actually restore is a very, very cheap business indeed. All we need to do is reduce the ludicrous number of sheep that we have roaming everywhere. They wish, as another of their six main aims, to promote resource efficiency and support the shift towards, you know what's coming, don't you guys? The shift towards low carbon and climate resilient economy in agriculture, food and forestry sectors. Promote resource efficiency and support the shift towards low carbon and climate resilient economy in agriculture. Well, I'm going to be experiencing a discussion soon about why it is that people don't respond to pleas to act on their carbon footprints and the fact that the world's getting warmer as a result of us, really, the common man. There's many, many people now who just don't accept that that's the case and that it's based on many, many false premises and the arguments I've not seen actually addressed specifically. So anything, as far as I'm concerning, that's supporting the shift towards low carbon climate resilient economy has definitely got its eye off the ball. And then again, that's in agriculture, food and forestry sectors. We're talking commercial language again. This is a commercial offer, basically. They wish to promote social inclusion, poverty reduction and economic development in rural areas. Well, once again, we can just say by their deeds shall you know them. If there was any sign at all of anybody promoting social inclusion, poverty reduction and economic development in rural areas, I might be more likely to take them seriously. But given the rest of the document, probably not. So there you go, there's their basic things. They want to foster knowledge and transfer and innovation, enhance competitiveness, promote food chain organisation and risk management, restore, preserve, enhance ecosystems, promote resource efficiency, support a shift towards low carbon and climate resilient economy and agriculture, promote social inclusion, poverty reduction and economic development. That is their main, that's basically the core. There's a lot of stuff underneath all of that, which I'm really not going to bore you with. But then, you see, that's complicated and general enough, isn't it? Because that, when you look at that, you can sort of see what they're after. They're after data again and ideas. But then it starts getting even more blurry around the edges, because all of these things, all of the activities undertaken by the groups that are being supported by these local action groups, they all must be linked to one of the five leader themes, the LEAD are all in capital letters themes. So there's another five themes as well as your six aims and your 18 focus areas, okay? And it says that the leader themes are adding value to, as we covered before, adding value to local identity and natural and cultural resources, which means capitalizing upon local identity and natural and cultural resources, facilitating pre-commercial development, business partnerships and short supply chains. Totally, totally commercial sentence. Every single one of them a totally dead, deadly word. And you could probably write a couple of pages just running that past an old version of Black's and seeing what you came up with, I would imagine. They want to explore new ways of providing non-statutory local services. That is every bit as threatening as it sounds, and we'll save that for next month. Renewable energy at a community level. Once again, we really don't see any of that at all on the ground, do we? All we see is massive windmills and basically people standing in the way of easily accessible, cheaply runnable hydro. Certainly where we are, you know, lots of people could have hydro here, no problem. But the extraction that you have to give to the charity that now runs the rivers, and what on earth is a charity doing having license money paid to it, makes it impossible. So once again, renewable energy at a community level. By their deeds shall you know them. Once more, if I saw any evidence of that happening, once again, we might feel like doing something more than just laugh at it. It's more like this really is knowing what we know about the way this place is being run, and we've commented on it loads of times before. It's this is a laugh. This would make really great stand-up comedy if it wasn't so sick. And then the exploitation of digital tech, as I said. And then, so you've got your 18 focus areas, your 6 main points, the 5 leader themes, and then all projects must address one or more of the cross-cutting themes. Capital C, capital C, capital T. Cross-cutting themes. The activities expected to be delivered and the expected outputs or results. There's another problem. Projects must address the activities expected to be delivered and the expected outputs or results. Everything has to be quantified, everything has to be timed and predicted. Straight away, we're starting to get into the real business of these fundings, and that is to tie people up in administration. Because that, in the end, is all this does, this whole thing. There is absolutely no hint anywhere in this document or in the Arwine document or in the job descriptions I've seen that go with some of the Arwine projects, to suggest that anybody's doing anything other than administering stuff, coordinating stuff, all of that. So anyway, one or more of the cross-cutting themes. And the cross-cutting themes, do you want to know what they are, folks? They are equal opportunities, including the Welsh language, sustainable development. It just really makes me want to howl. It's a really great one. Every time somebody uses that phrase, they should be pinned down and asked what they mean by those two words and what they mean when they put them together, for that matter. And they also wish to tackle poverty and social exclusion, which, of course, all forms of government encourage. Every time these people want more money, it is the poor they go to it for. So the idea that they're going to tackle poverty after 6,000 years of failing to do so is pretty much unlikely. And we know that when small people are excluded from their day camps, it's called, I think round here, it's called social inclusion. So they chuck you out of school and call that social inclusion. I wonder what they mean when they say they want to tackle social exclusion. See what I mean about the slippery words? So that's it. That's them. Everybody that's signing up to these types of projects and taking the shilling for it is signing up to this stuff. I'm sure Paul would agree with me. This is these are not just guidelines. As I say, I've seen a whole load of these sort of guidelines actually enforced in a public inquiry, which was definitely a judicial setting, and the guidelines were there being used to see that the kind of activities that we'd like to see on the land weren't going to be allowed to occur. So eligibility is a really important thing. And under eligible activities, I love this, get this one, under eligible activities, it kicks off by saying, it is not possible to give a definitive list of activities that are or may be eligible under leader measure. Now, that's the first time they call it the leader measure. But from here on in, it's called the leader measure pretty much all the way through. So it is a rule. It's a regulator. The leader measure, it's a bit unguarded of them, that is. And once again, I think I'll be, at some stage, I'm going to go back over this and go and look up the old meanings for these words, because some of them look like they're going to yield some good input. But hang on, where's this mute button? So it's not possible to give a definitive list of activities that are or may be eligible under the leader measure. Of the Welsh Government Rural Communities Rural Development Programme 2014 to 2020, and they ran an earlier version of this between 2007 and 2013. The information they gleaned from that has been fed into this project. So the beast that's being served by all this is called the Welsh Government Rural Communities Rural Development Programme, which is basically the Rural Development Strategy, but it's the country-wide version, you know, the big one. So it's sort of holographic in its nature. It's running at all levels, it seems to me. And we won't be looking at the guide notes to that. One of these is enough. But it says, but if the activity can be clearly demonstrated as supporting the achievements of the objectives of the Welsh Government Rural Communities Rural Development Programme, and the aims of the local development strategy, so they are two different things, it will be deemed to be eligible. So it's not possible to give a definitive list, but so long as it supports the Welsh Government, you know, Rural Development Programme and the local development strategy, it will be deemed to be eligible. Wicked. Isn't that great? See, that's very poor defining in there. Absolutely shocking. And now obviously there's going to be a bit of confusion there, isn't there? Really. because you've got to do then another load of reporting and demonstrating that the activity is supporting the achievement of the objectives which we outlined before. And I'm not going to go through them all again, but, you know, that's a lot of objectives that you could be claiming to support. But as long as it's doing that, as long as you're supporting the government development program, it will be deemed to be eligible. Well, that's just shocking, but obviously the confusion is going to be sorted. And here's the first of the dodgy groups that I haven't mined down to see who these people are, but it says sorry, it just makes me laugh every time I see this name. Advice can be sought from the Scheme Management Unit, known as the SMU, SMU, if there is any uncertainty. And I'm sure there'll be plenty of uncertainty. Just imagine, or look, you just want people to get together and do things. All are running around already that's involved in this to try and prove this, that and the other to a bunch of people who don't know one way or the other. It says that some examples are given in Annex A. I haven't got that far, but these are only illustrations, and activities are not restricted to these or similar examples. So that's pretty useful as well. Right. And now we get into the meat and veg of it. This word animation comes up a lot. It's great, that, isn't it? We know about animating, don't we? Because animating the dead is what the whole damn shooting match is about. But here we go. Number 27. And this says animation new. And it says revenue costs for people. And here we go with the admin guys, who will promote the opportunities of leader. This is likely to include other supporting costs such as room hire, travel costs, external consultancy work, technical reports, writing business plans, preparing project application forms. We don't like application at all, especially in the contractual sense. If you're putting in an application, there's likely to be duties and responsibilities. But apart from all that, weekly financial support and so on. These kinds of activities will support particular types of business and assist them to define their own problems and come up with workable solutions. Yeah, I'm sure. So all of that's admin. All that's just a big list of admin. And animation, the people that are animating the project will get money, basically. I'm not quite sure what revenue costs are. If somebody could, Andy's put in there, the SMU could be a race of ETs. I reckon they probably are. I don't know if anybody can come up with a decent definition for revenue costs, because the word keep coming up in this document, and I didn't get around to looking it up. Revenue costs. So they're going to give revenue costs to people who animate the project. They're also going to give revenue costs to people who implement and deal with project delivery. So that's revenue costs for people who will directly manage and deliver projects or provide support to organisations to deliver activities that otherwise could not take place. What do you mean that otherwise could not take place? They're suggesting there, I think, that if these people weren't so generously providing government funding, that we wouldn't have the wit to get it together. In fact, what's going to be really interesting is to see a project like this coming together in a place where human beings are this very moment getting themselves together and proving to be capable of doing quite complex jobs. Two things will be happening in the same place, which might make one thing look feasible when in fact something totally different is going on. We will have to wait and see. It's going to be great. And here's a weird one. It says in some instances, organisations may not have the resources to work on a defrayed basis. I didn't look that up either. So someone else, and here we go, here's another one. Usually organisations may not have the resources to work on a defrayed basis. So someone else, dan dan dan, usually the administrative body, capital A, capital B, supporting the local action group, could arrange to supply goods and services on their behalf. And I wouldn't be taking that sort of deal on either. And who the hell is this administrative body that's supporting the equally shady local action group? Actually, the local action group, in fairness, will be a bunch of the kind of people that might be associated with, you know, left-leaning thoughts and stuff. And it's exactly this kind of language which I think has foxed them into a kind of a bewildered servitude to somebody else's whims and mores. So you've got animating it, you've got implementing it and delivering it. Then you've got mentoring. So they're going to give revenue costs They're going to give revenue costs for people who provide support to organisations to help them develop their own skills and expertise. Well, I think this is just like development always was abroad. You get people from the Women's Royal Voluntary Service or other well-meaning, kind-hearted, compassionate people, I'm sure, sent out to show people how to garden and farm in countries where the people know better than their visitors how to garden and farm. So the idea that we're going to be giving revenue costs for people who provide support to help them develop, people develop their own skills and expertise is, again, shaky, I think. And it says it's a different approach to training. I'm not sure it's training. And then it goes on to training and it says they're going to give revenue costs for the development of more formalised courses to groups. This is another thing that is frequently encouraged by these funded applications, is the getting together of what they call formalised courses, just like that. We don't like the word formalised either. Quite often, they're these things called NVQs. I don't know what that really stands for, but I've seen them happening, and it looks to me like it should stand for non-vocational qualification. Very low-level stuff for which you have to have accreditation, licensing, and, of course, loads and loads and loads of health and safety stuff comes up into your purview, all of which is cost that goes pretty much directly to the world management team. So development of more formalised courses to groups. The subject matter and the intended outcome would have been determined by a skills assessment of some kind before the course was delivered, it says. That's what it says. It says the subject matter of the formalised courses and the intended outcome would have been determined by a skills assessment of some kind before the course was delivered. Another whole load of writing and talking and nonsense, I'm sure. And then it gets on to the thing that the people I'm interested in, I know, are getting involved in. They're getting involved in a feasibility study. So it's just that the idea is it's 3 years with about 20 grand's worth of grant for three people for each of 3 years, who I'm not sure actually bring any budget with them to do the stuff they're being paid to do. Which is shaky, isn't it? So feasibility study, it says they're going to give revenue costs for staff time and consultancy costs, once more, nobody's doing anything, to undertake the background research for a specific problem and the production of a comprehensive written appraisal, once again, another comprehensive written appraisal, of the issues, a word that they really do like, the alternative solutions, the financial costings, a detailed risk analysis, and recommendation for the next steps. Oh, easy. I'm sure that lots of the people who are getting this kind of funding are capable of doing that. Doing the background research for a specific problem, production of a comprehensive written appraisal of the issues, the alternative solutions, so you've got to look at other ways of doing it as well and explain them to them, the financial costings, of course, because that tells them what we're doing and who we're related to and with, a detailed risk analysis is all imagining people aren't kept safe by risk analyses. People are kept safe by people. Failing to train people to keep other people safe will lead to a lot of people getting hurt. Regulation won't help. And then they want you to come up with recommendations for the next steps as well. So this feasibility study is an interesting beastie, but it then says the conclusion of a feasibility study must not be a recommendation that a further study is necessary. And then, so that's what it mustn't be. But what it must do, right, this feasibility study, it must show, here we go, get your pens ready, a detailed description of the issue that any ensuing proposal is expected to address. So you're supposed to be one leap ahead even of all of this. And remember, most of these people will have actually no experience of doing these things. They're experiments. And by definition, your business plan, your costings, all of that, it's really not possible to do that sort of stuff until you've got some history and some data to work from. You know, under some circumstances you can if you've got a lot of experience, but it's a risky game, that is. So a detailed description of the issue that any ensuing proposal is expected to address, as well as all the stuff that you're already doing. The applicant, yes, it's an applicant, so he's begging, the applicant's current position in relation to the issue and what they are anticipated to do at the conclusion of the project. So details of action to be taken, why it's necessary, an explanation of benefits, an explanation of why existing structures cannot be utilised, and once more, dan, 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 a 3-year forward cash flow projection showing how it will be implemented and funded, a 3-year forward business plan, and a clear recommendation on the viability of the project. Now, I've seen how amateurs run spreadsheets, guys, and just that line, just that there, is that's a major challenge. It seems to me, looking around, that most of the people out there who are managing not only projects like this, but possibly even it goes as far as the Foreign Office, actually have very little experience of the actual physical work and the working out how much stuff you need to do something, how many people you need to do it, how long it's going to take. And then adding all of that up to come up with some kind of a reasonable timescale for doing the job and some reasonable idea of how much it's going to cost, you know, within, I'd reckon within 10% is good enough for a big project. But it's not only that most of these organisations don't have people in them actually doing that. Most of the organisations, well, a lot of the organisations I've stumbled into recently don't even have people who realise that that is necessary. And the result is just really an ongoing organisation, a set of ongoing organisational and interpersonal catastrophes that are only being kept on the road by money coming from somewhere else because bits of paper have been signed, which oblige people to, which basically bring people within the kind of realm of this kind of guideline for which read instruction, how you are going to behave. But that 3-year forward cash flow projection, a 3-year forward business plan and a recommendation on the viability of the project. Well, man, I could just about get around to doing that for horticultural projects, and indeed we are doing it. That, but like I say, most of this is not stuff that's been done before. And with all of these people running around talking to each other and consulting with each other and getting technical reports done and all of that, I can't imagine that any good's going to come out of it. They deal with pilot projects, travel costs, evaluation. Oh, yeah, evaluation, number 34. Hello there, matey. How you doing? I'm talking to the world on the radio. Evaluation, number 34. Get your laughter buttons ready. Get your laughter buttons ready. Under evaluation, it says a key outcome of the projects delivered through LEADER is to shape future projects. Full stop. Obviously, I've cut quite a lot of stuff out of that, but that's the core sentence of that one. A key outcome of the projects delivered through LEADER is to shape future projects, which is exactly what they did with the last LEADER program. The costs of having an independent external evaluation can be met from LEADER funds. So there you go. Once again, that's an audit. That's more administration. That's more stuff not getting done. It's people talking about things that might be being done by other people and writing about things that might actually or might not be being done by other people. As with the One Planet development, and again, I haven't seen the details of this yet because these seem to be secret. There seems to be some pretty hairy monitoring actually comes along with all of this as well, like I say, just as it did with the One Planet development. Then it says capital expenditure is not eligible, number 35. Capital expenditure, never eligible, mate. You can spend your money, your $20,000 a year, on administrators, but we're not going to let you buy something you might use. You can be sure of that. But then that gets even better. This is another good one. This capital expenditure in terms of these, the LEADER program anyway. Capital expenditure is any single item with a value of more than £10,000 and a useful life of more than a year. So you can't buy shit like that, okay? But small items would not be classed as capital because such items would not need to be entered onto a capital asset register, it says. What is a capital asset register? Do you know what a capital asset register is, Paul? But evidently the implication there is that if you do buy stuff that costs more than £10,000, and I've never done that, which has a useful life more than a year, that you are believed to be obliged to enter that item onto a capital asset register, in which case, of course, it ceases to be your asset and becomes registered to somebody else. So it says capital expenditure is not eligible, but that only applies to stuff over £10,000 that's not going to last. That's only stuff over £10,000 that's going to last more than a year. Anything other isn't capital expenditure, and so might be eligible. Once again, very, 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 very fluffy. Ineligible activities, loads, mate, loads. The LEADER measure, once again, there it is, the LEADER measure cannot be used to provide a system that would constitute state aid. This means that local action groups cannot provide any assistance that would reduce normal operational costs, such as giving financial support towards rent, rates, energy costs, or any other running costs or overheads. Well, I'm sorry, but if you're taking on three or four extra people that you're being paid to take on, then it is going to get more expensive to run things. And sometimes these people come with no budget, so they're going to be needing extra travel expenses. They're going to be costing you money. That's what people do. They'll be costing you money and time. And it doesn't look like they're planning on earning very much necessarily. And it certainly looks like they can't help you buy things and they can't help you reduce the rent, the rates, the energy costs or any other overhead. So whoopee, dead useful. The LEADEE measure cannot be used to provide capital or revenue grants or other forms of assistance to commercial businesses. And they underlined that, so they're obviously serious about that. Here we go again. Here's another one. Eligible costs. We're nearly there, guys. So thanks for your patience. Eligible costs, number 38. It is not possible to define expenditure that is eligible under the LEADEE measure. Full stop. It is not possible to define expenditure that is eligible under the LEADEE measure. Well, you're not doing your job properly, then, are you? What sort of guideline is that? Eh? Honestly. And then number 39, if that wasn't enough. Number 39 says, if the expenditure is necessary to support the delivery of the objectives of the local development strategy, then altogether now it is deemed to be eligible. So long as you're supporting the aims of your local government, they'll help you. And then numbers 40 and 41 are a 1.5-page list of ineligible things. And after them, it also tells you that you could get advice from the scheme management unit at SMU if there's any uncertainty. And that's about the end of the interesting stuff. There is a whole load of other things, but we're going to cut to the chase next time I come on and have a look at the Arwine project and some of the actual job descriptions that are being put out for tender here. So this now is everywhere around us. This is how things are run. People don't understand that actual budgeting involves having some experience of the thing you're budgeting for and coming up with an accurate idea of what it's going to cost and how long it's going to take. It doesn't mean saying, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to make 12 grand and then only make two or whatever. I mean, that's another thing is that I've seen a lot of, as well as dodgy use of spreadsheets, is people being shockingly, shockingly way out on their estimates and all that kind of stuff. And as a low logistics bod, I really can't be having with that. So all of this, that's, I'm sure you'll forgive me for going through that. Hopefully you did enjoy that. There's a lot more of that out there. But the thing is, the reason why I brought this one up is because this, I guess, is another kind of nailing it to the mast job in as far as we are going to be playing in very close quarters to a project that is going to be expected to adhere to these rules. And to the all of that complexity at the beginning about this thing, that and the other. So they're also going to be having to go in with the Arwine rules, which are slightly different, slightly more modern. And they've got some pretty amusing stuff in them anyway. But that's basically the hard work on that done for you. It really does help reading these documents if you can get rid of a load of the unnecessary words. So here we go. We're going to go on to a couple of tunes, a couple of short tunes before I come back with you. And we have a quick look at that Associated Allied Airlines, American Airlines, a paying passenger got basically beaten up, bloodied and dragged off the plane by federal policy enforcement officers. A particularly important 10 minutes of podcast, I think. We'll get on to that after some tunes, though. In the meantime, here's The Rut and Babylon's Burning, because it definitely is, and possibly quite a good idea to try and set fire to a bit more of it, figuratively, if we possibly can. Great, kick it. Listening to Dr. Rock's Summer Season from the people that brought you Dr. Rock's radio show on autonomousmedia.net. That was the Talking Heads and Road to Nowhere, and before that, The Ruts and Babylon's Burning. Enough said, I think. Well, the next bit of the magazine is some work by people I've been watching for a while. I bet you've seen them as well. They're called Arth and Melissa Dykes, and they run a YouTube channel and a website called Truth Stream Media, and they do some very penetrating and punchy little reports. This one is called Fly the Fascist Skies, and it's going to be an occasional slot on the summer season and the autumn radio show when it comes back, of what I call killer pods. Pods that you just watch and you think, my goodness, there is so much stuff in there that if people saw it, it would hopefully make them start to think about what's going on. I think that these two guys, these people from Truth Stream Media, they do a great job of tidying up. It's a pretty brutal video. I really recommend that you actually go and watch the thing itself. But the commentary and stuff does a really good job on the audio. So I don't think there's too much stuff where you're going to be distracted by the lack of picture. So it's just over 10 minutes long, nearly 12 minutes long. And then I've got, as usual, you'll be well used to, I've got a few things that I'd like to say about it. Because, really, guys, you know, what have we come to?
Society is being flushed down the toilet. As we speak, we're watching it happen. People want to try and deny it, but you read history, you read about the fall of civilizations, and then we all sit around and go, but we have technology, so we're all so civilized that that couldn't possibly happen now. And yet, if you look at some of the things that are happening, there's no other explanation for it. And one of the ways you can find out right now, you want to know how free you are in America, how much of a police state this is, how much of a fascist police state we're living in, just go buy a ticket and try to ride on an airplane. First of all, that's even if you make it on the plane, because you have to go through the guilty until proven innocent, being treated like a total criminal, walking through TSA, getting molested, radiated at the very least. And who knows what could possibly happen to you or your children going through that process before you even get on the actual plane. It takes forever just to do that. But then once you get on the plane, you can now have the shit kicked out of you and be drug off the plane for doing nothing wrong at all. That's the level we're at in the country.
You just have to wonder what's next, how they're going to ratchet it up, and how much further people are going to continue to justify things. Oh, you don't have any rights on a commercial flight. That's the company. Really, you don't have the right not to be beaten and dragged out of your seat because they have some policy about replacing you for airline employees?
So let's set this up. This is what happened. Some of you may have heard of this, but if not, I'm about to show some videos. United Airlines had a flight from Chicago to Louisville that was overbooked. They overbooked by policy because they're a crappy company and that's what they do, okay? And so they started asking for volunteers to get off of the plane. This is once they already had everyone on there. They wanted four people to give up their seats because they needed to get four of their employees to Louisville for other flights. So it wasn't even for a reason that wasn't on the company. It was totally on them that they didn't have their employees at the right place at the right time. But they wanted people to volunteer. So they started offering a couple $100. Well, most people are not going to take that because of the hassle nightmare they have turned flying into in this country. Once you've gone through the entire BS of having to get all your stuff, make sure your shampoo is in a 3-ounce bottle, get to the airport hours in advance so you can go through TSA where you're treated like a total slave criminal and do all that stuff just to get on the plane. You don't really want to get off of it and then have to screw your entire plans, do that again. Most people can't afford to miss work and just change what they're doing. And so people didn't take it. So they said $400, no one took it. They said $800, no one took it. So then instead of just continually raising the money until someone did, which is what they should have done since it's completely on them, instead they said, we're just going to have a computer start randomly picking people and forcing them off the plane. So they forced three people off the plane. They got to the fourth person. It's a doctor who needs to get to patients. That's one of the reasons he's trying to get back to where he's going so badly. And he refuses to leave his seat. And so this is what happened. He sent security onto the plane. Physically yanked him out of his seat. That he paid for. Slamming his head into the armrest. Dragging him down the aisle like an animal. That's his blood.
Busted his lip.
Yeah, that's what they did. Let's look at that from another angle so you can see exactly how he was treated.
Pilots drive to Louisville? Can't they rent a car for the pilots and have them drive?
Ah! Ah!
right here.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Watch his head.
Oh my God!
That would be his face slamming into the armrest and busting his lip open.
Oh my God! What are you doing?
And everyone just pulls out their cell phone. Why? Because we have been so conditioned in this country in the last 16 years since 9/11 to become complete and utter slaves, obedient slaves on an airplane. Everyone just pulls out their phone and they just sit there. Let me ask you a question. What would have happened in this instance if everybody would have just stood up and stood in the aisle? It's a small plane. 30 people get up and stand in the aisle. What are these people going to do? Pull a gun? And do what? Shoot into the air of a cabin filled with passengers in a multi-million dollar plane? I don't think so. They would have had to let the guy go.
Well, why didn't someone else offer up their seat if he's a doctor and they heard him saying that everyone's business was that, you know, but that's how they've conditioned people because that's someone else. It's not you. And the airlines have been conditioned that their passengers are not people. They're cattle. They're animals. And there's so many people always packed in and someone's always complaining. They've stopped seeing them as human beings. And their company has told them to treat them like animals. And with all the TSA and paranoid security stuff, they've just come to view it that way. So they're used to screwing people over. So they think it's weird when people don't roll over and ask to be screwed.
I mean, if I had seen this happen, if I was on this flight, I would have stopped this before security had to even be called. I would have gotten up out of my seat in like the Hunger Games. I volunteer! I would have been the tribute. I would not have let it get to this
point.
Maybe,
right? Somebody on the plane.
Somebody should have. And then it came to this.
I have to go home. I have to go home. I have to go home. That came me. That came me.
This is the level that we're at in this country. Okay, this is how late the hour is. You have people so afraid to fly, then they do fly, then they're bloodied and begging for their life on the plane. Okay, you know what happened? They had to pull everyone off the plane to clean this man's blood up off of all of the seat rests because it flew everywhere after they busted his head open on the armrest. So the flight ended up being hours delayed anyways. They ended up not making it. The employees that needed to get to Louisville so bad, they couldn't, by the way, probably just rent a car and drive from Chicago to Louisville and get there in time. Ended up not getting there in time. No one got there in time because the thing was delayed 2 hours over this. The point is, this is just how, this is the level that we're at. This is how conditioned everyone is. The man is standing there. Look at this guy trying to like pretend like this isn't happening right now. No, it's happening right now and you're sitting there not doing anything about it. You're just taking it. We're all just taking it. Everyone's just taking it. Everyone's taking it. I wonder when things are happening like, you know, Nazi Gestapo squads going through the streets, rounding people up, stuff like that. Was there ever a moment where people stood around and looked and said, this is it. This is the moment that we knew that our whole thing was falling apart and that everyone was a total slave and that we did nothing to stop this, that we did nothing at all. We didn't even try.
But people are so afraid of being the unhammered nail and standing out and being noticed that they'll all become slaves. No one will stand up. I mean, that's the next level of the conditioning is people's reaction. And for everyone who's outraged about this, there's people who are like, always comply with Leo's no matter what. Why is the doctor behaving this way? With all due respect, I thought he was a professional doctor. He should have been dragged out with dignity.
I mean, that's the level of that's the 1984 Orwellian level of conditioning that we are at. That people are watching this kind of thing happen and then making excuses for why that's okay.
The airports are a fascist place. You already have to go through TSA. The airline industries pretty much have guaranteed business. They're more pulled together than they are competition. Yeah, they do compete with prices to a certain extent. But as far as the operation of the airlines, you can't choose a non-Gestapo airline. It's all Gestapo airlines. They just have different logos and stuff. You have to go through the conditioning. You have to be patted down. You have to be treated like a suspect. And then if your number gets called, you have to volunteer for the sacrifice. It's crazy.
You're not just flying. You're flying the friendly skies.
It's crazy. And when customers complain, they get blamed for not submitting enough. And then people bitch and moan about, well, it's a private company. He should have read the terms and conditions. He doesn't have any rights on a flight. He has the right to be beaten to a pulp.
It's not really a private company when they're using federal authorities to enforce their bullshit policies. Airport police. So, and by the way, it says Chicago Aviation Department. It says the officer involved in dragging the man off the flight was placed on leave. Of course, they will do that for a little while.
He'll get paid while he's on
leave. He'll get paid while he's on leave, and they'll just do that for a while until the horrible PR dies down. And the only reason this story went viral like it has is because people were filming it and talking about it on social media. That's why now the mainstream media has been forced to even really turn it into a whole thing, because everyone freaked out so badly when they saw this, because they know this is how bad things are. And you know what they'll do next? Next they'll say you can't have your phone on the plane. They'll try to just say you can't even have it at all. Not for any other reason other than CYA, cover your ass, to cover themselves so that people can't film incidents like this, just like they don't let people film at border crossings. That's next. I think I appreciate maybe this tweet the best. Congrats, United. You now have all the volunteers you could ever want giving up seats on your flights. I hope that actually is, at least I hope, there's a huge boycott of this ridiculous airline and the horrible way they've treated their customers. But I think the reason people are so outraged by this isn't just the actual what happened. It's everyone can sense it. Everyone can feel it sinking in. The level that this society is at, we're all on the Titanic. They're playing, the band is still playing, but the ship is still sinking. And guess what? It's still going to end up on the bottom of the ocean, no matter how you rearrange the deck chairs to make them look pretty, and no matter what nice violin songs the band continues to play. That's still what's going to happen. And everyone can feel it. We can all sense it, like we're in that thing in Star Wars where the wall, the trash compactor walls are slowly moving. Everyone can feel that happening. Okay, and this is one more tick on the notch of that belt. What would have happened if all the people on the plane got off the plane then? I think it would have made a statement. I wish people had more courage. I wish people weren't so brainwashed. I wish people weren't so programmed to be slaves. You will continue to be treated like a slave if you continue to act like one.
That was Arthur Melissa Dykes, and the little soundtrack from there. 12-minute vid, Fly the Fascist Skies. Very startling, I thought. It really, really in your face. One of the main things about that, of course, is that that's exactly where it is. And how people responded. Well, it's again, it's pretty recognisable human traits that are being exploited there, I think. It was called Fly the Fascist Skies because that little, you get to hear and see one of their TV adverts which says Fly the Friendly Skies with United Airlines or whatever. Well, that's dead friendly, isn't it? And we may say, as is often said, well, that's America, isn't it? They're a bit nutty over there. But we may say it's not happening to us, but it is us. We genuinely have no rights on a commercial flight. We genuinely don't. Men and women sign any rights like that they have away by agreeing to the terms and conditions, and subsequently by effecting payment for the flight. These are making a contract, and your rights go out the window in the process. And as if that weren't enough, this kind of dereliction of rights, and apparently responsibilities, it would appear as well, is confirmed by the very act of turning up, as it were, in person. So, one way or the other, though it's not obvious to most people, it could be argued by the lawyers that this man was asking for it, which is cruel but true. And this whole shooting match, because, you know, in essence, that's what it is, folks. It's just a shooting match. It's one massive, all-encompassing commercial flight, the whole trip that we're on. So that each day and each month and each year, we buy a series of tickets that permit us to be treated as packages in the transport of commerce. Yeah. Packages in the transport of commerce. And what's inflicted upon and suffered by other men and women is an invitation for it to happen to others. And as we'll hear when we get to the holographic paradigm bit of it, it's not only an invitation for it to happen to others. If it's happening to one, it's happening to all of us, because it is all in an inseparable whole. And it is in no man's interest, it seems to me, for there to be tanks on any street, for bombs to be falling on any land, or for violent agents to be making imaginary corporations real by inflicting physical harm and temporal loss on any man. And I think both of those things were caused to this poor unfortunate. And again, it's not that this is not us. Banks, mortgage companies, the entities that we call energy suppliers, the entities that we call councils and governments are all bludgeoning the livestock. Just as those federal officers bludgeoned the man on the plane. It is all so subtle, isn't it? Finely tuned blend of money and false information and societal suggestion and slippery words. There was nothing slippery about what happened here, though, was there? It was an auction. It was an auction that ended up in a man getting beaten up in front of lots of other men and women. But for this particular volunteer, he didn't step backward quickly enough. The words were surely in the terms and conditions. I bet they were. We're fortunate, aren't we, in UK PLC? We're frequently and mercifully reminded when we're travelling around on public transport that luggage left unattended may be removed, damaged or destroyed by the insecurity services. Well, seems this piece of luggage was left unattended and it was damaged by the insecurity services, just as predicted. Caveat emptor, eh? For the man on the plane, it seems to me the results of seemingly widely accepted false information was that all this is somehow okay and there's no need to respond in any way. And I'll admit straight away, I can't be sure. In fact, I'd tend to put my money on the fact that I might well have been that bloke sitting looking up at the air vents and just pretending that it wasn't happening. But having watched that video and thinking about it, just that in itself might be enough to change my behaviour, to make me start thinking just exactly what I might do. Because obviously, like the lady said, even if it's, look, have my seat. You can have the $400 and the hours of my life you've stolen and all of the assault and no doubt robbery and all the rest that goes on the way in there. Just leave that poor bloke alone and I'll go and you can buy the beers or something. But the idea that it's somehow okay to just whip out our phones, I mean, okay, that's why it went viral on the web and stuff, but there was only three of those officers and there was a whole plane load of people. Again, I suppose we're reminded, aren't we, all the time in the movies and we say, oh, move along, there's nothing to see here. Very clever programming. And many, many millions of us are being treated like cattle and alas, really agreeing daily to be so treated by buying the ticket and then taking the ride. And as time's rolling on, there are an ever-increasing number who are really not even lucky enough to be needed any longer on the farm. There's never been a shortage of resource to kill the creditor and seize his assets and ambitions. And like it said in a little bit, everyone feels the trash compactor walls closing in and they do the little Star Wars scene there. And yet, it seems that an utterly amazing majority film all this happening and do and say nothing. Perhaps the digicam is the new fiddle and we're distracted by from the flames. Eh? I thought his comments about the unhammered nail, and I find myself wondering whether the apparently unhammered human nail is genuinely unhammered. You can't be an unhammered nail by pretending to be a hammered one, I don't think. Which is fortunate for us because that makes it relatively easy to spot the fake ears amongst us. Anyway, thank God that wasn't me. You know, that seems to be the basic thing instead of, you know, really, for Clapton's sake, this just won't do. What if that had been, you know, my granny or my doctor, you know, or my offspring? So what if that had been me, you know? It's like a whole plane load of kind of people that don't have empathy, isn't it? Or are too frightened to move. And we know that the other part, humans can do the other thing where, we talked about this before as well, where, you know, somebody can be just out walking the dog and there's some other geezer or whatever about to throw himself off a bridge. And sometimes people will risk their own life, you know, and their offspring's fatherness and their husbandness to the wife and all of that to save a complete stranger. It's, again, some people get in the way, some people don't. And it's time to start getting in the way, I think. Whatever happened, you know, to the golden rule, it's everywhere. The do unto others as you would be done by. That seems ultimately very fair to me. And it is a bit like the holographic paradigm, as it turns out. Absolutely ubiquitous. It's found everywhere, all over the world, right throughout history. Do unto others as you would be done by, which obviously includes probably thou shalt not kill unless you're feeling particularly desperate. Oh, sorry, mate, it's been amended, you know? It's do unto others before they do unto you now. It's for your own convenience and safety, and you can trust us to keep you cosy and warm. Keep you cosy and warm, at least. Honest. Don't wash, does it, really? And all of this happened because United Airlines needed to unload some livestock, which they owned, for a period of contract evidenced by the ticket. They wanted to unload the stock because employees needed to get from A to B in order to service the company's needs. Of course, the employees are assets of the company, and so they're owned in a slightly different way. It all boils down to the same thing. Nobody got anywhere that day. By the way, employee is interesting. Employee as an asset. Made me go and have a look at the old 1920s blacks, and it says that it comes from the Norman French, and it originally meant, you know, only originally, of course, doesn't mean it anymore. Employee originally meant government agent. Black Second says employee is more extensive than clerk or officer. It signifies anyone in place or having charge or using a function as well as one in office. I thought it was interesting they had the words using a function as opposed to performing a function. It made me wonder how often we're being a little bit blinded by that one. Once again, you can see what I mean by the slipperiness of the word. Those employees were needed to be got on a plane because they had to be somewhere else. And basically these guys are not only not efficient, they apparently deliberately overbooked their planes and stuff like that. So that's not on. That means they're offering people contracts that they can't fulfil. Pretty much by definition, pretty much on a daily basis. And of course, that's not a satisfactory way of doing business. Well, I don't think it is. It's clear there's a lot of people out there who clearly disagree with me. Anyway, everyone on that plane witnessed a fellow man bloodied and beaten and repeating the words, "I have to go home, don't kill me." They saw uniformed federal officers in the form of airport police dragging him down the aisle like an animal. He'd effected payment for a seat, been treated like a criminal on his way to the plane. He refused an offer of gaming tokens to leave. I love the auction to leave the plane. I mean, 400, all give me 400. 800, all give me 800. You know, all take 800. And then eventually it just turned, well, okay, sod it. We'll beat one of you off the plane instead. So he was eventually selected by a computer, and, oh, you know, in fairness, his own wanton intransigence, to take a good drubbing at the hands of men in fancy dress. Absolutely as bizarre and outrageous as it gets. And it wasn't really, in fairness, just the security officers and the airline who'd ceased to see passengers as human beings, you know, or at least other passengers. You know, got to be a fair bit of that shared with the plane. And he puts up, in the video, they put up a little... I guess it's a Facebook thingy or something, put up a screenshot, and it says it's a lady called Angela White in Las Vegas. "With all due respect, does a professional doctor behave this way? What? Why disregard the instructions of an LEO on a commercial flight?" That's presumably local enforcement officer, probably. "The feds don't play on inappropriate AC behaviour," she says, whatever that means. "I'm sure the full story will come out, and not just what this video shows." Well, I mean, look at the video. It's taken from two angles, and you heard the sound effects, but it's just like... and then there's another one they quote, which says, "The flight was overbooked," which is a nice quote. This is another bit of the slippery word thing, this use of the passive sense. "The flight was overbooked," not "we overbooked the flight." You see, it's failing to take responsibility, which is... And this is where failing to take responsibility is leading us, of course. We did actually gather a load of really, really nice plastic boxes that were found in the road, main road outside the town after they'd fell off the back of a supply lorry, the driver of which assured us that the lorry door didn't shut. So they've got self-shutting lorry doors now, haven't they? Anyway, one of the most important things about all of this is what happens there. I did a psychology A-level many years ago, which, although it didn't count for anything, was actually one of the more informative qualifications that I ever did. I learnt a lot of very useful stuff. And one of the things I learnt about is bystander apathy, the thing that makes us not want to run to the rescue of the man who's about to lob himself off a bridge. You know, and we think we justify it. We think, oh, well, I'm sure he's got a good reason for doing that, or maybe he likes cold water or whatever, and we will come up with absolutely outrageous excuses for not doing something. And this is a really, really well-researched area of psychology and well worth looking into. And a bit like the best way of getting to a psychopath is to say, I recognise you and you are a man operating without empathy or whatever. The bystander apathy thing, it's been discovered that one of the main reasons it happens is because people don't know it's happening. So just by introducing people to the concept and getting them to think about it, and getting them to realise that under some circumstances they might be being bystanders when they might better be doing something else. So she says, what do you do? Stand up and obstruct a whole plane full of people, men with guns, not going to use the guns. I mean, offer up a seat. And all of that, like we said, implies just so much hassle getting on the plane in the first place. Or I quite fancy quietly and en masse pressure the officers into leaving. This was a technique that was used very effectively by the audience at Stonehenge who were watching the Here and Now band on a night when Satan's Claw motorcycle gang decided to come into the festival and start robbing people of their whatever it was they'd been earning and stuff. And the band said, look, you know, if we're not going to have the police on site, we've got to police it ourselves. And so there was, I don't know, I can't remember, I was a bit trashed and it was a long time ago, but there was quite a few people and the Hell's Angels left, quietly exerting en masse pressure in a small space. You know, there was a lot of stuff that could have been done there, I think. But, you know, bystander apathy, and I'm not saying that I would have done that either. I'm freely admitting that I suspect myself of having a yellow streak down my back. But I'm a different man now from the one I used to be. Or just get up and leave, everyone. Just bloody get up and leave. You've just seen one of your fellow passengers beaten up in front of your very eyes and dragged off the plane by the insecurity officers. What on earth would you want to do staying there? Let them have the $400. Let them have all the hassle. Just don't go back. You know? What? It's one of the single most powerful things we've got, I think, is where we spend our money. And what are people doing spending their money with people like that? Anyway, the result was that no one got to where they wanted to go. And all of the men and women so affected had also each been similarly invaded and abused to get onto a flight that was going nowhere. They were on a flight to nowhere. And all by a company which, we're told, deliberately books more punters than there are seats. And so is presumably patronised by folk who are happy and perhaps sometimes even paid actually to be treated this way, simply to save a few meaningless promissory tokens. And you know what United Airlines posted? This is the crack. Here's the punchline before some music. This is an upsetting event to all of us here at United. I apologise for having to reaccommodate these passengers. Our team is moving with a sense of urgency to work with the authorities and conduct our own detailed review of what happened. We are also reaching out to this passenger to talk directly to him and further address and resolve this situation. On that basis, I reckon the best thing the good doctor can do seems to me is, hide. Basically, hide somewhere where they're not going to find you and help you anymore, mate. Quick. Oh, dear. Totally amazing. What kind of world is this? Not by any means for the first time I find myself really asking how much more obvious does it need to get before people start getting mad as hell and refusing to take this anymore? You know, how much more than that does it take? Personally, of all the stuff I've seen, and there's been a fair bit of it now, this is, like I say, one of those that everyone might benefit from giving the necessary 12 minutes of their life to. It's got fake news versus real news. You know, that was that certainly didn't look staged. It looked more like your handheld camera type movies and all that kind of stuff. So the fake news versus real news, that looked really real. And it only got picked up by the legacy media because it went viral on the web. And again, like other things, I don't suppose anything will happen. But it does show that it's possible that things will change. But of course, the next thing that will happen is they will simply have your phone off you on the way onto the plane, which is another good reason for just not using them and staying local. As most of you know, I gave up flying many years ago because I just don't like men with guns. Anyway, and then there's citizen journalism versus basic human decency. You know, filming it evidently gets the information out there, but does it get anything done? Had there been a bit of basic non-violent non-compliance at that stage by everybody, then there might have been a different outcome, but I guess we won't know now, will we? Hopefully, people who are going to get involved in things like that are going to see this video before it happens and get a chance to think about it before they get shit scared and not unreasonably frozen to the backseat of Fido 21 or whatever. What would you have done, eh? What would you have done? Anyway, basically, our view of our world needs to change, because at the moment, our worldview is changing us. This is not the world that I was born into. Nous sommes l'homme sur la plaine, nous ne sommes pas les bystanders apathétiques. You know, don't want to be, at this stage, pathetic, apathetic bystanders. Spread the word. Truthstreammedia.com, Arthur Melissa Dykes. The doctor reckons that this is one tidy piece of work, elegantly tidied. And, of course, they're being hugely demonetized, as the phrase goes, at the moment by the Nazis that are running the internet. So I think it's probably time for another tune. Having had a quick look at that, that really was. It really did shock me. That was a bit of, for me, that was brutal viewing. I don't really get a lot of that. Oh, yeah. So we've got, Slap Your Mama Big Band. I'm just going to have a quick look at the full name for this, because it's actually called, this is, yeah, it's Screaming Miss Jackson and the Slap Your Mama Big Band, another Fire in the Mountain band. From their album, I Heard the Voice of a Donut, and it's called 21st Century Satan, Hell Toupee, which is the giveaway. I think if you listen carefully, you'll probably hear a reference to Armageddon, old Trump in the middle of it. Gives away the subject of Hell's Toupee and 21st Century Satan. Cracking song, it is. Here we go, a few minutes of music, then we'll be back with a bit of Holographic Paradigm. How's that? That was the Runaways and the Cherry Bomb, and you're listening to Dr. Rock's Summer Season on AutonomousMedia.net, the monthly internet radio magazine show going out on the last Thursday of every month from 8 o'clock till 11 o'clock, if all goes according to plan. 3-hour show, we still go to 11. And next up, we're going to slide seamlessly on to some Michael Talbot, I think, and the Holographic Paradigm. And we'll just have to wait one moment whilst I find the necessary file, which will hopefully not be far away. There we go. This is another thing that we've done a lot of on the show, is looking, it's been one, an interest of mine for many years, and it's what I ask for when I come across various bookstalls, especially Buddhist bookstalls. This is a good thing to ask for. I look for books where magic and science meet, or where magic and religion meet, or whatever, and see what people have got to say about it. And one of the subjects that we keep returning to, and I know Jack's done a lot of work on this, and we've done several shows on the holographic universe and associated ideas, which of course is absolutely everything, haha. But one of the best books I've read on the subject, really great summary of the whole thing and loads of amazing individuals work in it. It's a book called The Holographic Universe by a man called Michael Talbot. And this is basically the first in a three-part series, which will happen over the next 3 months. This is the idea, you see, it's cunning. It's going to get me a bit ahead of the game. And it's the last bit of the book, which is called A Return to the Dream Time. And it's about the implications of holographic theory on for consciousness and its relevance to the cosmos. And this is where I'd like to go quite regularly in the later stage of the show, is to some of the more metaphysical solutions, because it's not only through the misleading use of words, though it is actually largely through that, that we're creating our own reality. It seems that some other reality is being bent by our consciousness into what appears to be the outside world, and that's what's actually happening. So, like I said earlier, when we played the Slade song with Nothing Can Change the Shape of Things to Come, as one of the key lines in it, it seems that far from that being the truth, it may be that everything is coming about as a result of us. So far from not being able to change the future, it is us that are creating it. So, and this science and religion thing's really interesting. It's one of the ways the world management team seems to be steering and guiding us so successfully, is because by and large, they're quite good at spotting natural what seem to be at least natural human mores, as far as we can tell, in this deeply conditioned mash that we're in. But they take kind of what seem to be basically pretty much kind of population-wide drives and harness those innate drives in the human being. And science and religion both do that. The cynic might even suggest that science is a modern replacement for religion, and that scientism would be a more accurate word, and there are several very decent tomes out there on that very subject, but that's not what I'm interested in tonight. At the moment, it seems to me that in the 21st century, the desire for gnosis, you know, realization, understanding what's going on, whatever we want to call it, is somehow being satisfied by listening to or reading of a whole series of unnamed scientific experts as they first tell us one thing and then another. Basically, it's just a series of inadequately answered questions, and some of the questions are pretty dishonest as well, because things are getting airbrushed out. So science has become a kind of religion, and it's not just me that's saying that. You know, this is precisely what prompted Bruce Lipton to move from the physical to the metaphysical, and subsequently, of course, to write The Biology of Belief and his second book, Spontaneous Evolution. And he originally went to the scientific side because he didn't fancy religion. You know, just he explains this in The Biology of Belief. And 10 years, I think he was something like 10 years into his scientific conditioning before he awoke to the idea that what he was actually dealing with was dogma rather than rational inquiry. He did a lot of very useful work, though. Very interesting. He was working with stem cells back in 1968. But basically, it was the structure of the scientific education and the fact that you had to do a whole load of years research in somebody else's laboratory. And we know what it is, don't we, folks? It's compliance testing. Only some people are going to rise through that kind of process. And Bruce Lipton awoke to the fact that basically what he was dealing with was not science, but religion. Which is a shocking idea to some scientists, I can tell you. I've tried it, and it's one of those things like criticising the NHS that's likely to get you a good kicking. Anyway, science, particularly physics, which is regarded as kind of the heart of science, if you like. It's the science from which all else springs. Science and religion have been occupying the same ground in a, you know, in quite a profound sense for a long, long time. And now I think it's becoming more obvious that that's the case. And always, I think the best expression of it is that is the physicist and the Buddha joke, where the physicist has spent a lifetime climbing up a mountain, and when he gets to the top, he finds the Buddha there. And he is naturally a bit startled, being a physicist, and says, "What the fuck are you doing here?" broadly. And the Buddha says, "What took you so long?" And that is more or less what's happening. And the place, the scientific theory in which that I think is really happening, is this this holographic end of things. We deal with the first part of this that I recorded a reading of earlier on. It refers to a couple of people with whom you should have heard, I think, probably both me and Jack Glantzoff, and I've done some quite detailed stuff on. David Bohm is one of them. He's the man who came up with the idea of the implicate and the explicate order, that there is another, there are so many orders of reality beyond this one, and that the real action is happening in this place called the implicate or hidden or enfolded order, and we're living in a place called the explicate order, which where everything kind of unfolds into it and then sort of folds back to where it came from. It's quite a genius alternative to what's known widely as the Copenhagen solution, which is the best guess explanation to the most weird aspects of quantum theory, particularly that black dog of objectivists everywhere, the double slit experiment, in which the form that matter or energy takes seems to be critically dependent upon not only the physical design and execution of the experiment, but also on the consciousness of the observer and the nature of the device being used for observation. So David Bohm came up with an alternative explanation which actually makes a lot more sense, not only of the double slit experiment, but actually of a lot of paranormal stuff and other things too. The other man is Carl Pribram. He was a brain man, a neurosurgeon, and having read Bohm's work and having done a lot of work with memory and lots of other things, a basic summary of Pribram would be to say that he suggested that our brains, that consciousness sort of isn't in our brains, but instead our brain is an organic entity which is interpreting signals which we're receiving from a holographic frequency domain. It's a frequency interpreter receiving frequencies from a holographic domain which is beyond this one. And the processed result manifests as the world around us, somewhat miraculously. And so that's a little bit of an introduction as far as I can. I'll tell you what I think about that when I listen to it on the podcast. But in the meantime, we've got coming up it'll be about 10 minutes in the first chunk of really amazing stuff about how holographic theory is tied into ancient texts, shamanic activities all over the planet. And it's basically science and religion possibly coming of age. And also in this slot in future shows, we are going to be dealing with what appear to be evolutionary changes in the way men and women are doing things. And let's face it, folks, we better hope there are going to be some evolutionary changes, eh? So here we go. Dr. Rock reading Michael Talbot from his amazing book, which, again, I really recommend you get. It's The Holographic Universe, and it's called this particular bit of it's called Return to the Dream Time. Return to the Dream Time. And it begins with a quote from the Lakota shaman, Lame Deer, from Lame Deer's Seeker of Visions. Only human beings have come to a point where they no longer know why they exist. They don't use their brains, and they have forgotten the secret knowledge of their bodies, their senses, or their dreams. They don't use the knowledge the spirit has put into every one of them. They are not even aware of this, and so they stumble along blindly on the road to nowhere, a paved highway which they themselves bulldoze and make smooth so that they can get faster to the big empty hole which they'll find at the end waiting to swallow them up. It's a quick, comfortable superhighway, but I know where it leads to. I've seen it. I've been there in my vision, and it makes me shudder to think about it. So where does the holographic model go from here? Before examining the possible answers, we might want to see where the question has been before. In this book, I have referred to the holographic concept as a new theory, and this is true in the sense that it is the first time it has been presented in a scientific context. But as we have seen, several aspects of this theory have already been foreshadowed in various ancient traditions. They are not the only such foreshadowings, which is intriguing, for it suggests that others have also found reason to view the universe as holographic, or at least to intuit its holographic qualities. For example, Bohm's idea that the universe can be viewed as the compound of two basic orders, the implicate and the explicate, can be found in many other traditions. The Tibetan Buddhists call these two aspects the void and non-void. The non-void is the reality of visible objects. The void, like the implicate order, is the birthplace of all things in the universe, which pour out of it in a boundless flux. However, only the void is real, and all forms in the objective world are illusory, existing merely because of the unceasing flux between the two orders. In turn, the void is described as subtle, indivisible, and free from distinguishing characteristics. Because it is seamless totality, it cannot be described in words. Properly speaking, even the non-void cannot be described in words because it, too, is a totality in which consciousness and matter and all other things are indissoluble and whole. Herein lies a paradox, for despite its illusory nature, the non-void still contains an infinitely vast complex of universes, and yet its indivisible aspects are always present. As the Tibet scholar John Blofeld states, in a universe thus composed, everything interpenetrates and is interpenetrated by everything else. As with the void, so with the non-void, the part is the whole. The Tibetans prefigured some of Karl Pribram's thinking as well. According to Milarepa, an 11th century Tibetan yogin, the most renowned of the Tibetan Buddhist saints, the reason we are unable to perceive the void directly is because our unconscious mind, or as Milarepa puts it, our inner consciousness, is far too conditioned in its perception. This conditioning not only keeps us from seeing what he calls the border between mind and matter, or what we would call the frequency domain, but also causes us to form a body for ourselves when we are in the between-life state and no longer have a body. In the invisible realm of the heavens, the illusory mind is the great culprit, writes Milarepa, who counseled his disciples to practice perfect seeing and contemplation in order to realize this ultimate reality. Zen Buddhists also recognize the ultimate indivisibility of reality, and indeed, the main objective of Zen is to learn how to perceive this wholeness. In their book, Games Zen Masters Play, and in the words that could have been lifted right from one of David Bohm's papers, Robert Soule and Audrey Carr state, to confuse the indivisible nature of reality with the conceptual pigeonholes of language is the basic ignorance from which Zen seeks to free us. The ultimate answers to existence are not to be found in intellectual concepts and philosophies, however sophisticated, but rather in a level of direct, non-conceptual experience of reality. The Hindus called the implicate level of reality Brahman. Brahman is formless, but is the birthplace of all forms in visible reality, which appear out of it and then enfold back into it in endless flux. Like Bohm, who says that the implicate order can just as easily be called spirit, the Hindus sometimes personify this level of reality and say that it is composed of pure consciousness. Thus, consciousness is not only a subtle form of matter, but it is more fundamental than matter, and in the Hindu cosmogony, it is matter that has emerged from consciousness, and not the other way round. Or, as the Vedas put it, the physical world is brought into being through the veiling and projecting powers of consciousness. Because the material universe is only a second-generation reality, a creation of veiled consciousness, the Hindus say that it is transitory and unreal, or Maya. As one of the Upanishads states, one should know that nature is illusion, Maya, and that Brahman is the illusion maker. This whole world is pervaded with beings that are parts of him. Similarly, the Kena Upanishad says that Brahman is an uncanny something which changes its form from every moment, from human shape to a blade of grass. Because everything unfolds out of the irreducible totality of Brahman, the world is also a seamless whole, say the Hindus, and it is again Maya that keeps us from realizing there is ultimately no such thing as separateness. Maya severs the united consciousness so that the object is seen as other than the self, and then a split up into the multitudinous objects in the universe, says the Vedic scholar Sir John Woodruff. And there is such objectivity as long as humanity's consciousness is veiled or contracted. But in the ultimate basis of experience, the divergence has gone, for in it lie, in undifferentiated mass, experiencer, experience, and the experience. This same concept can be found in Judaic thought. According to Kabbalistic tradition, the entire creation is an illusory projection of the transcendental aspects of God, says Leo Schreier, a Swiss expert on the Kabbalah. However, despite its illusory nature, it is not complete nothingness. For every reflection of reality, even remote, broken up, and transient, necessarily possesses something of its cause. The idea that the creation set in motion by the God of Genesis is an illusion is reflected even in the Hebrew language, for as the Zohar, a 13th century Kabbalistic commentary on the Torah and the most famous of the esoteric Judaic texts, notes, the verb baro, to create, implies the idea of creating an illusion. There are many holographic concepts in shamanistic thinking as well. The Hawaiian kahunas say that everything in the universe is infinitely interconnected, and that this interconnectivity can almost be thought of as a web. The shaman, recognizing the interconnectedness of all things, sees himself at the center of this web, and thus capable of affecting every other part of the universe. It is interesting to note that the concept of Maya is also frequently likened to a web in Hindu thought. Like Bohm, who says that consciousness always has its source in the implicate, the Aborigines believe that the true source of the mind is in the transcendent reality of the dream time. Normal people do not realize this and believe that their consciousness is in their bodies. However, shamans know this is not true, and that is why they are able to make contact with the subtler levels of reality. The Dogon people of the Sudan also believe that the physical world is the product of a deeper and more fundamental level of reality, and is perpetually flowing out of and then streaming back into this more primary aspect of existence. As one Dogon elder described it, to draw up and then return what one had drawn That is the life of the world. In fact, the implicate explicate idea can be found in virtually all shamanic traditions, states Douglas Sharon in his book Wizard of the Four Winds, A Shaman's Story. Probably the central aspect of shamanism, wherever in the world it is found, is the notion that underlying all the visible forms in the world, animate and inanimate, there exists a vital essence from which they emerge and by which they are nurtured. Ultimately, everything returns to this ineffable, mysterious, impersonal, unknown. That was, hang on, there we go. Yeah, you can probably hear me. Oh, I'll say to it. Just these a little bit, that's better. That was... Sorry, I still have a bit of trouble with my sounds at this end. There we go, that's better. That was me, Dr. Rock, reading Michael Talbot, Return to the Dreamtime, and this is Dr. Rock's Summer Season, the monthly internet radio magazine show, going out between 8 and 11 on the last Thursday of every month, probably through till October, and then we'll be back, hopefully, into the normal routine. For people who have been listening to the show for a long time, a lot of that will actually be kind of revision because a lot of those people and names we've actually covered. But if you listen to it again in the pod, there's one or two really cracking sounding books in there, which we will be diving into, I think, at some point. There seems to me, as well as this holographic thing being a fascinating idea in itself, that is now being supported by a substantial amount of... quite sharp minds in a substantial variety of scientific guises. But I love some of the phrases in there are particularly resonant to the work that we do with words. We were listening at the beginning of the show to the way words can be used to basically pull the wool over our eyes. But it's also great, isn't it, to hear writing that's properly done. When I look at our local papers, I really can't read more than kind of like a couple of paragraphs because it's just not worth reading. Michael Talbot has done a really great job of taking all the, what a massive subject that is, and he in three or four pages really covered a whole world of material, really. But I love that phrase, all forms in the objective world are illusory. All forms in the objective world are illusory. And forms are a very legal thing. It's how everything is being kind of swept into a heap. And if you stay outside the forms, by and large, you can stay outside the system more effectively, at least, or, you know, mitigate its impact upon you, shall we say. All forms in the objective world are illusory. Objective is a word that just ceases to mean anything when everything is connected to everything else, as we'll hear in a later episode on this particular subject. And illusory is exactly what it is. And the thing is that it's whilst we believe the illusion that we attract to ourselves the energy bodies that reinforce the realness of the world around us. And that is why when we start seeing through the illusion, the world starts treating us differently. If, for example, one's entire consciousness is not focused entirely on getting the money necessary to keep the rats off your back, and instead one can concentrate a little bit on what one wants to do and being creative and being in the natural world and working with people that one wants to work with, it's a completely different world that treats one differently. Different things happen as a result of no longer chasing the money. And, of course, there's the big fear thing as well. Another thing that comes up a bit later in this, and we've heard so many times over the years that getting rid of the fear is the most important first step. All forms in the objective world are illusory. Almost worth having it tattooed backwards on your forehead, isn't it, so that you see it every morning, just to remind you how crazy things actually are. Another phrase that struck me as being particularly resonant to do with the law and the words was subtle, indivisible, and free from distinguishing characteristics, because, of course, distinguishing characteristics is what we're more and more being boxed up with. There should be none, not, you know, just a man moving freely on the face of the earth or whatever. Distinguishing characteristics, describing the holographic thing as subtle, indivisible, and free from distinguishing characteristics is actually pretty much what I think is what we're trying to achieve. You know, it's just that sort of quiet life. The part is the whole. The reason we are unable to see the void directly is because our conscious mind or inner consciousness is far too conditioned in its perception. Absolutely right. Heard a lot of stuff about conditioning in the piece about the man on the plane. And it is really, nobody's going to decondition us. Nobody's going to free us from our addictions of mind. We have to do that absolutely ourselves, because obviously, once again, for a very, very long time indeed, the game has been played the other way around. Seems to me the obvious thing to do, again, the frequent piece of, you know, this is the most useful thing you can do, is just ditch the media. They have become, they haven't been worth reading, watching for the last 10 years, but they are just so outrageously bonkers now that it's not worth it. Ditch the dictionary as well. The words that you think are safe are definitely not safe. Simple words is what we need to be using. We need to be playing, not working. We don't need to be employees, do we? We don't want to be government agents or people using a function or whatever they said. And we need to, as Chris Diogi suggests, we need to start responding to the world as we experience it and our felt responses to it, rather than our conditioned response to those felt responses, if you know what I mean. Not easy. Not easy, is it? And then they said, to confuse the indivisible nature of reality with the perceptual pigeonholes of language is the basic ignorance from which Zen seeks to free us. It's also the basic ignorance from which we seek to free ourselves if we're dealing with what the language is doing to us, what it actually means, what a contract is, how it's all constructed. Then what we are trying to do is free ourselves from perceptual pigeonholes, you know. The laws apply to us because men with guns say they do. Not something that occurs to most people, but that is breaking the mold. That is getting out of a pigeonhole. That is ceasing to be a bloody pigeon. It's important as well that we grok, again, this idea that matter emerges from consciousness, not the other way around, because that is an absolutely, literally, quite literally, groundbreaking idea. And as that particular extract showed, it is pretty much worldwide and time-wide. It is how our ancestors thought of the world, that matter emerges from consciousness, not the other way around, because, of course, orthodoxy believes that consciousness arises from the physical matter of the brain, whereas Carl Pribram believes that consciousness is a response, is a sort of interpenetrating sea and field of holographic resonance from another domain entirely. Brilliant. So that was summed up in the phrase, the world is brought into being by the veiling and projecting powers of consciousness. So it's just like Freeman Jack says, when we get a bigger telescope, we just can project bigger ideas further into space and then get confused about them. And in the process, believe that we've actually sorted the stuff that is obviously close at hand. Anyway, it's basically described as an uncanny something which changes its form in every moment from a human shape to a blade of grass. And, of course, this, once again, is about not having the distinguishing characteristics and the fact that all forms are illusory. Because what our bureaucracy does and our politics is get in the way of that. Get in the way of the kind of transformations we're capable of making when we cease to chase the things that our societal ambitions encourage us to chase. Probably the central aspect of shamanism is the notion that, underlying all the invisible forms of the world, animate and inanimate, there exists a vital essence from which they emerge and by which they are nurtured. Very beautiful, that, I think. And there's the key. There exists a vital essence from which we emerge and by which we are nurtured. And that nurture is not apparent whilst we're chasing fake money and forced to spend our time doing things we don't want to do with people we don't want to be with. As those things are ditched, and it doesn't all need to be done at once, a little bit at a time does the job in my experience. In fact, it's a little bit surer way of going about it. Big changes all at once can be iffy. But what happens is this thing, synchronicity, a kind of bridge, if you like, between mind and matter, starts occurring more often, and the world treats you differently. The more deconditioning that you can manage, the more the synchronicity works, and the more we are likely as men and women to find ourselves doing the things we know we need to do, rather than the things that we're being encouraged, funded, conditioned, or otherwise manipulated into doing. Ultimately, whatever, it doesn't really matter, because everything returns to this ineffable, mysterious, impersonal unknown, as they finished there. This always has been really cool to the Dr. Rock's internet radio outings. This idea that our solutions, the solutions to the big problems, are relatively local because they're all solutions to do with consciousness, and how we treat each other and how we treat the world is absolutely more key than what is going on the news or the propaganda that is masquerading as things like weather forecasts. And I find this material and all of the supporting stuff, I've read so many of the books and some of the papers that are associated with it, I find that it is encouraging. And one of the things that we seriously need, it seems to me, is to be encouraged, because it's the discouragement and the fear and the confusion about the words and the fact that the people that we are, the people that we're in the game with are experts. We've been doing it a long time. That makes life difficult for us. Anyway, there's just a little bit more of the Michael Talbot coming up, and I'll have a quick look at the chat box whilst that's playing. So, yeah, about another 5-6 minutes of him. That's really great as well. Hope you're enjoying it. Let me know in the chat box what you think about the new magazine format, because the stuff you let me know you like, I'll endeavour to do more of. And otherwise, I'll just do what the hell I like. That's what I've always done before. Anyway, back to Michael Talbot. The candle and the laser. Certainly one of the most fascinating properties of a piece of holographic film is the non-local way an image is distributed in its service. As we have seen, David Bohm believes the universe itself is also organized in this manner, and employs a thought experiment involving a fish and two television monitors to explain why he believes the universe is similarly non-local. Numerous ancient thinkers also appear to have recognized, or at least intuited, this aspect of reality. The 12th century Sufis summed it up by saying simply that the macrocosm is the microcosm, a kind of earlier version of Blake's notion of seeing the world in a grain of sand. The Greek philosophers Anaximenes of Miletus, Pythagoras, Heraclitus, and Plato, the ancient Gnostics, the pre-Christian Jewish philosopher Philo Judaeus, and the medieval Jewish philosopher Maimonides all embraced the microcosm-macrocosm idea. After a shamanic vision of the subtler levels of reality, the semi-mythical ancient Egyptian prophet Hermes Trismegistus employed a slightly different phrasing and said that one of the main keys to knowledge was the understanding that the without is like the within of things, the small is like the large. The medieval alchemists, for whom Hermes Trismegistus became a kind of patron saint, distilled the sentiment into the motto, as above, so below. In talking about the same macrocosm equals microcosm idea, the Hindu Visvasara Tantra uses somewhat cruder terms and states simply, what is here is elsewhere. The Oglala Shu medicine man Black Elk put an even more non-local twist on the same concept. While standing on Harvey Peak in the Black Hills, he witnessed a great vision, during which he saw more than I can tell, and I understand more than I saw. For I was seeing in a sacred manner the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all shapes as they must live together as one being. One of the most profound understandings he came away with after this encounter with the ineffable was that Harney Peak was the centre of the world. However, this distinction was not limited to Harney Peak, for, as Black Elk put it, anywhere is the centre of the world. Over 25 centuries earlier, the Greek philosopher Empedocles brushed up against the same sacred otherness and wrote that God is a circle whose centre is everywhere and its circumference nowhere. Not content with mere words, some ancient thinkers resorted to even more elaborate analogies in their attempt to communicate the holographic properties of reality. To this end, the author of the Hindu Avatamsaka Sutra likened the universe to a legendary network of pearls said to hang over the palace of the god Indra, and so arranged that if you look at one pearl, you see all the others reflect in it. As the author of the sutra explained, in the same way, each object in the world is not merely itself, but involves every other object, and in fact is everything else. Fa Tsang, the 7th century founder of the Hua Yen school of Buddhist thought, employed a remarkably similar analogy when trying to communicate the ultimate interconnectedness and interpenetration of all things. Fa Tsang, who held that the whole cosmos was implicit in each of its parts, and also believed that every point in the cosmos was its centre, likened the universe to a multidimensional network of jewels, each one reflecting all others ad infinitum. When the Empress Wu announced that she did not understand what Fa Tsang meant by this image, a and asked him for further clarification, Fartsang suspended a candle in the middle of a room full of mirrors. This, he told the Empress Wu, represented the relationship of the one to the many. Then he took a polished crystal and placed it in the centre of the room so that it reflected everything around it. This, he said, showed the relationship of the many to the one. However, like Bohm, who stresses that the universe is not simply a hologram, but a hollow movement, Fartsang stressed that this model was static and did not reflect the dynamism and constant movement of the cosmic interrelatedness among all things in the universe. In short, long before the invention of the hologram, numerous thinkers had already glimpsed the non-local organizations of the universe and arrived at their own unique ways to express this insight. It is worth noting that these attempts, crude as they may seem to those of us who are more technologically sophisticated, may have been far more important than we realize. For instance, it appears that the 17th century German mathematician and philosopher Leibniz was familiar with the Hua Yan school of Buddhist thought. Some have argued that this was why he proposed that the universe is constituted of a fundamental entities he called monads, each of which contains a reflection of the whole universe. What is significant is that Leibniz also gave the world integral calculus, and it was integral calculus that enabled Denis Gabor to invent the hologram.
Find your own true way. Breathe.
Catch the silence of the mind. Send it up.
Andy Hickey and the Merry Maidens off I'd Rather Be Rambling and Universal Mind. Send it out and multiply the feeling of the universal mind. Perhaps we do have the power after all. Perhaps science agrees with us. It does turn out later in the tale that actually there's an awful lot of scientists sitting on our side of the seesaw but pretending to be on the other side, as it were. So, tipping point. That's what seesaws are all about, isn't it? Anyway, I want to... last bit of the show is going to be, as you'll be aware, I haven't been around at all, really. Not only not doing a show, but as I say, I've not really been listening to anybody else. And broadly speaking, going out, coming back home and going to sleep after a bit of a chill. Synchro and I are also constantly having sort of chats about what it is we're going to do next, because we're having a real screamer of a time. Working as you might have gathered in, we've now got control of 5 polytunnels. And the last bit of the show is going to be a chat about that. 7 weeks in the market garden, it's called, because that's how long we've been now. I've just put a link in the chat box for it. internetradio.drrock.biz/downloads. Is the address, and then it's called 7 weeks in the market garden with a 7 number at the beginning because I was feeling sloppy. So got a bit of time to get that one downloaded before we move on to it, and I'll just pass a bit of comment if I may on the candle and the laser, which I really enjoyed whilst you kind of download that. There was a rather cryptic reference there to one of David Bohm's mind experiments involving a fish and two television monitors, basically. And the idea there was, if I remember rightly, that you have one monitor looking at the side of the fish and one camera looking at the side of the fish, one camera looking at the front end of the fish, or another angle, and they're both showing on the monitors kind of like the movement of the fish from that position of perception, as it were. And, of course, unless you knew about monitors and all that kind of stuff, the electronics, you might assume there are two fish not one. And that's basically the key to the whole thing, only with an infinitude of fish and an infinitude of everything else that isn't fish too. I love the idea that what is here is elsewhere. That's a very synchro type comment, that is. We've often had this idea that we might put together a calendar of her strange ideas, and what is here is elsewhere would really, really fit in well with that. By the way, talking about that, when I just potted through the kitchen for another hobgoblin, the posse were in there wrapped. They were very silent and actually paying attention. So hire posse, tar for that. Obviously, the new format's working well for them. And the World Mountain, I love that idea as well. It's really important. It had me fox, because as many of you will know, my entry into the world of weirdness really was through the gateway of the Mayan calendar and the myths of the Maya, something that I still love and use. And one of their ideas, as everywhere else in the world it would appear, is that, you know, their local mountain is the World Mountain. All points are the centre and the circumference of the thing is nowhere. Particularly, we might say that's true for human consciousness, mightn't we? Each object in the world is not merely itself, but it involves every other object and, in fact, is everything else, as they said there. And got to make a second honorary mention of James Corbett here. It looks like, yes, indeed I am. James Corbett, really, my God. I mean, we watch Suspicious Observers every morning for the weather forecast, because you know that if you're mentioned on Suspicious Observers, you're in for some serious stuff. And it keeps us up to date on all manner of releases of scientific papers and animations and stuff to do with the electric universe. So we like that. We have that every morning with our porridge, pretty much religiously, we might say. But the other man we've come to really like, he was actually recommended to me years ago, and I didn't get around to him. And I don't know why, because, you know, it's up to you. Is he a fake news misinformationist, as seems to be being claimed by the orthodox managers of the World Wide Web? Or is he the web's best kept secret, which is what I think he is personally? He's not. He's absolutely not said a word I disagree with. And what I really enjoy about it is that he frequently has his finger on the pulse a good few years before most people have spotted even that there's a body in the room. You know, very good to be able to go, you'll remember we brought this up 5 years ago, and here's the article, or, you know, whatever. Very, very excellent stuff. Penetrating analysis and very personable too. And he recently recommended a thing called iPencil, which I took a look at. It's not very long. You can watch a video of it or you can read it. I recommend reading iPencil. Not very long. Totally, totally brilliant. Beautiful piece of simple writing expressing the most complex of ideas, which of course coincidentally is kind of what we've been trying to do tonight, really. It's what we're always trying to do. That's why I'm so tired. But James Corbett, excellent edutainment and simply beautifully written, that iPencil. It's a real treat. And I really particularly like the idea that Leibniz, the man who came up with the differential calculus, which eventually led to the laser, which itself led to the hologram, which itself is a kind of Rosetta Stone to this entire complex and deep subject. I love the idea that Leibniz was familiar with Ha Yen... Buddhism, really brilliant, really great that. So we're now going to find out, hopefully, why it is. Can I follow that link myself, can I? Let's see if I can pull up my own slideshow, because I don't remember what I put in there. Oh, there we go, yeah, okay. Because now we're going to get, this is what's actually going to be going on over the next 6 months, really, whilst I'm trying to develop a new radio show that's more amenable, is we're going to be doing lots of this sort of stuff. It's something me and Synchro have longed to do. Our core part of this overall mission is to grow herbs and chilies. We will be growing other stuff, as you will see. Because of the nature of the place, we are taking photographs of absolutely everything on the way through. Because one of the things I'd like to show you over the coming shows and months and years and whatever is how to do all of the things that we do. And this is, if you like, an introduction, a bit like this whole show is an introduction to the summer season and the future, hopefully, of Dr. Rock's radio broadcasting, is to show you each week kind of slides. And this is an introduction because it shows some of the stuff we've done only in the last 7 weeks and only part time. We have been doing a lot of other stuff as well. Firstly, I must say that I'd like this to be smaller. Oh, that'll do. Thank you very much, Mr. Screen. 7 weeks in the market garden. I called it a market garden because a really nice man called Jack popped by the other day. I wanted to know what a market garden was, what the difference was between a market garden and a small holding. And he said, basically, it's the statistics. he said, you work backwards from when you know demand will be and you make sure that you're growing the stuff. Well, that's exactly what we're doing. We don't have any background data, but we do have some really fierce spreadsheets gathering all the data as it happens. The first picture on the 7 weeks in the market garden slide is a picture of a lettuce. Isn't that great? We've been using Gold, this fantastic compost that we will see later on, hopefully, in the next slide, I think, in fact. And it has within it lots and lots of really fairly innocuous weeds, the occasional thistle, but no nettles or anything. There's bittercress in there. There's various bits and bobs. But look at the little lettuce. Isn't that radiant? And as soon as the lettuces appear in a row, then you can start weeding around them and stuff. But you'll see, it could be a lot of fun. And the thing is that your pattern recognition systems, once you see that, you're away. So we're going to whip through this quite quickly. The second slide, main compost, March 2017. If you look at the left-hand side picture, there is a massive compost heap there covered in stinging nettles and who knows what, lots of rotting pallets. You can barely see where it was. If you look at the back of the left-hand picture, you can see a little beech tree and a white panel. That's going to be an important reference point, that white panel. On the right, if you look at that, that's a picture from the end of the compost heap, along from right to left, as it were, in the left-hand picture. And you can see the little beech tree. So basically, the whole compost heap is twice as wide as what you can see in the left-hand picture. And the next one, main compost April 2017, is the first of a extensive batch of sturdy compost heaps that I'm going to build around the place. So by April 2017, we've now got a functional compost heap. It's got compost in it, boards at the front of it. So you'll see an updated photo of that if you're at the news from the polytunnel session at the end of whatever next month is. Is it May? It is. Oh, sorry about the rather aggressive font size there. Polytunnel Tom, March 2017. This is the thing, is that it's extremely difficult to stay on top of the infrastructure of these things. And once it starts going, you get this kind of effect. The idea of the polytunnel is to have a raised bed at least 3 inches, I reckon. Yeah, 3 inches really is workable, so that you can keep chucking good organic material and compost and stuff onto the top of it, because that is what keeps it all turning over. It's what means that it can hold moisture and all that kind of stuff. If you look at the soil in Polytunnel Tom, March 2017, it's extremely degraded. It's in fact as degraded as those two beds themselves are. The path down the middle has almost disappeared. You can see that Synchro's been working on the bed on the left, and looks like some natural crop is being developed on the bed on the right. I'm still a bit confused as to which all of these places are, tell you the truth, because they're a bit confusing. Anyway, next slide is Polytunnel Tom, April 2017, where you can see we've taken the two beds from the previous slide and we've put in a proper edge and then a black carpet, which will stop anything growing in between. The psychological importance of this can't really be overestimated. It is a lot more fun working in a polytunnel that looks like that than it is working one with vague edges. And if you've got all sorts of volunteers coming through the place, as we do, then needs to be a comfortable place to work. The edges there are built out of what we get from they're offcuts from a local sawmill. They basically chop all the barky bits off. They're all broadly the same width, but some of them are really lumpy and all that. And we get that £10 for a huge van load. So that's easily accessible stuff, if you like. And we have to buy the pegs, although we do have some guys on site called Men in Sheds who are fantastic. We're going to be getting on well with the Men in Sheds. I have a lot of 2x2 offcuts, and I think I'll be able to give them one of these pegs and all my 2x2 offcuts and say, yeah, can you make me some of these out of this? And they probably will, which will be absolutely great, because otherwise they're 60p each plus the VAT. Next polytunnel is a polytunnel called Hugh. This is what it looked like when we arrived in March 2017. And in fact, it still looked like that until about a week ago, until we went in there last weekend and did Polytunnel Hugh April 2017 with the much friendlier font at the top of it. There it is. You can see we've got soaker hoses lying there. This is a really amazing rainwater delivery system. But unfortunately, the soaker hoses aren't up to the job, so we're going to be forced to investigate 4mm micro irrigation from gravity fed rainwater collection systems. That's going to make for an interesting little set of photographs. Next one along is pernicious weeds, March 2017. This is one of the biggest problems of community ventures, is what do you do with the stuff that won't compost? And there was a lot of it about. In all fairness, the people here had actually managed to keep all this stuff separate from the actual compost heaps, although there were nettles on top of the compost heaps, what we found when we mined into them, as you will see in future, hopefully, was absolutely excellent stuff. This, on the other hand, is tat and garbage, some of which is actually still growing. And there's some horrible reeds and things in there. Those are three separate bins that you can't really see. It wasn't possible to encompass the scale of the problem and the challenge on just one photograph, even with these magical digital cameras with their imaginary film. So there you go, pernicious weeds. What do you do with bindweed roots and established docks and seeding nettles and all that kind of stuff? Well, this is the answer. That's what it looked like in March 2017. In April 2017, it looked like the next slide. And the pernicious weeds have all been compiled into that single pile there that's under a piece of black plastic with two pallets on top of it and some lumpwood holding it all down on top, because that will probably stay there. We'll open it up in a year and show you what it looks like, but I reckon that it'll take 2 years before we can use that. But when we go in there, it will be soil. Everything in there, all the roots, all the leaves, everything. We don't put sticks in there. The next two, the ones with the black carpet on them, they are what was left. Those are both compost piles, basically, with usable stuff in there for us. Probably a couple of cubic metres plus, I would think. Beyond that, you can see two corrugated iron bays. We've now already filled one of those with more pernicious weeds, which we have wrapped in, first in clear plastic, because we had it, and then we covered it in black plastic, and that too won't be looked at for a couple of years. So that's moving on apace, and it makes that place so much tidier. It gives people somewhere to put the things that they need places to put, which is, you would have thought, the most simple lesson, wouldn't you? But so often places end up in a mess because things that are constantly produced one way or the other, or by-produced, don't have anywhere to go. So key is, give them somewhere to go and tell people where it is, and they will do the rest. Next one, vegetable bed, March 2017. We have done a lot of mulching here. You can actually see, if you look beyond, just beyond the end of the vegetable bed, March 2017, there's two sheets of plastic there with more lumpwood holding it down. Those are a pair of beds that we, as soon as we got there, we started mulching. There's another three big long ones with plastic mulch on top of them, and they got coir on top of them to hold them down. And another big boggy area that's got a massive piece of plastic on it, with which we will have to do something ingenious. But down the rough end there, right down the far end, we're going to be planting mulleins and evening primrose and woad and tall, beautiful plants that smell nice and that the bees like. And we're on a major spread the woad project, actually. We've got a lot of woad and it is beautiful. So here we go. You've got a bed. This one had been cultivated last year, I reckon, but there was a bit of an interruption in service or something, so it's got a bit overgrown. Because it's cold and we're concentrating on the polytunnels, what we were interested in doing is trying to reserve some of these places and get them back in some sort of shape, or at least stop them from getting any worse, so that when we do get to them, we've got something easy to deal with, and mulching is the way to go. Black plastic, very cheap. Some people say it acidifies the soil, which it may do, I don't really know. One thing it does do is hold the moisture in really well, heats up the weeds really well, and unlike the Mypex, which is a kind of woven, semi-permeable mulch fabric, it doesn't have a load of Mypex's disadvantages, which disadvantages are actually the subject themselves of a series of slides showing you how they kill birds and make places for nests for mice and loads of other things. Next one, vegetable bed, late March 2017. I'm scuttling because I want to be out on time just to prove I can do it. Vegetable bed, late March 2017. You can still see the right-hand side of the bed remains unmulched because we had a limited amount of material. The dark brown stuff on the right-hand side of that is gold from one of the compost heaps we mined when we took it all apart and built the new ones. Fantastic stuff. And on top of that is a weekly supply we get of a 1 cubic metre of fresh horse manure mixed with hemp. How fabulous is that? So that's horse manure, which you can safely use fresh, especially for this sort of purpose. with hemp on top of our compost gold. Now I can reveal that the whole bed has been covered in that and is now covered in black plastic, exactly like vegetable bed mulched, that like the next photo along. And that will basically stay there until such time as we want to move out from the polytunnel with peas or whatever, and we want to start planting out. And this is probably the first bed we'll go to. As the year goes by, we will remind you and show you photos of what's growing in there, and we'll keep you up to date. We've also got photos of the things that aren't working so well, which we are subsequently experimenting with and taking more photos of, so we'll be able to give you a bit of a guide on pests and diseases and how to overcome some of the problems. Next one, herb, chili and more, is a photo of the place. We're putting in a load of volunteer hours at this community enterprise in order to have access to this particular unit, and these are seeds and seedlings and plants grown from plugs, and we intend to show you how to sow seeds of different sizes, how to deal with plugs, how to take cuttings, all photographic little slideshows that will come at the end of Dr. Rock's radio show in future to give you something nice to think about on your way to bed. The greenhouse is the next shot. This is an absolutely far out place, actually two greenhouses, and Jack noticed it, very nice. Every single bench in there, Jack, is a bottom heated propagator. All of that is bottom heated space. It was very grubby when we got there, full of mice and wood lice and all sorts of things. And as a result, we got a bad dose of root fly in the broad beans, which has been dealt with. If you want to know how we did that, you're going to have to tune in, aren't you? But you'll be all right. You can tune in late because the greenhouse stuff will be coming at the end of the show. So there you go. That is why I've not been online. I'm not being insulting or anything, but that's what we've been doing the last 7 weeks. All that infrastructure work and growing all those seeds. So we're going to try and keep you up to date on all of that as we go through Dr. Rock, you know, from the potting shed, as it were. Had a bit of a -5 last night, actually, Jack, and we've got a tomato factory. We've got like best part of 100 tomatoes in big pots that we're going to plant up with other crops around them, like spicy mustard crops and rocket, wild and tame and mixed salad. So that you'll actually be able to make sandwiches from a pot for probably the best part of a summer with the tomatoes and all of that. That's a good plan. And all of it will be photographed and presented here so that you can see it going on for your summer upliftment and all the rest. In the meantime, we have just about made it to the end. And just try and rearrange that. Can we do that? Yes, we can. And I want to stick this one over here as well. We might even make it out on time. I will be back at the end of next month, which I've already decided is May. In the meantime, Freeman Jack is very kindly filling the seat and keeping the slot alive. Thanks to all those people who've been in the chat box tonight. And like I say, honest criticism of the new format will be gratefully received, whatever you've got to say. We're going to play out in memory of the United Airlines guys with Don't Sit Silently. From Tracy Curtis's Thoughts in the Dark, because it's such a beautiful song, and you know, I don't sit there and scream either, frankly, do something. And that's going to be followed by, I know people have said a lot they've enjoyed the bits of poetry reading we've done, which haven't been a lot. We're going to be doing more. It's going to be, after Tracy Curtis, a little reading from a Will Watson poem called Housing Crisis, and it came out of the Dr. Rock out of the Dark Mountain Literary Journal Volume 9. They're coming and doing some more work at the Fire in the Mountain Forum this year. And it is a great poem. Really, really like it. So, bit of poetry. And inevitably, also with the United Airlines guy in mind, we're going to have a second dose of Motörhead, as promised. And on your feet or on your knees, because that's the only option now. And don't want to be on our knees begging, do we, folks? Thanks a lot for being there. Summer season starts 8 o'clock, runs through to 11, last Thursday of every month, including next month, which is May. Thanks for being there, folks. We'll try and get the pod up, but you've seen how it is. Tracy Curtis, see you soon. Thanks for being there.
I'm not especially clever, but I know we need healthcare that's for everyone and one that's free, regardless of your race or social ranking, one that doesn't ask the balance of your bank before it scrapes you off the floor, having decided you're worth more. So don't sit silently while governments take what belongs to us. I don't mind paying taxes, but I'd like a say in where my money's going and for what I pay for useless wars and fat MPs' expenses, royal weddings, bailing out the bankers as we scrape them off the floor, having decided they need more. So don't sit silently while governments take what belongs to us. I'm not especially clever, but I know we need healthcare that's for everyone and one that's free, regardless of your race or social ranking, one that doesn't ask the balance of your bank before it scrapes you off the floor, having decided you're worth more. So don't sit silently while governments take what belongs to us.
Housing Crisis by Will Watson. I never lived in a house of native stone lugged from glacial fields over the hard scrabble 100 years it took a hillside farm to found a name, sink a root cellar. Older then than now, with the hidden atelier first for runaway slaves and then a half-mad poet uncle who never taught me the dark rhyme of his defeat, because I never lived in his house of native stone, but instead dreamed a dune top, Frank Lloyd Wright, with louvers of Lake Michigan dust, never found on any street or map, though I tried dead reckoning, until dead beat from crashing barbed wire backyards, until the time I never lived in a bald cypress shack, with cotton mouths to be swept off piers before checking the trot lines, and an illegal salt lick within buckshot by magnolia woods. Or in a sooty brick row house near steelworks where my father, like his before, and me, and my sons after, sloughed off steel-toe boots while our wives beefed about the racket and the stink from the steelworks, which was not the hurricane house, where I didn't ride it out behind 5/8 plywood sword sharp, hung tight right before, where I neither chopped through first the ceiling then the roof when the doors blew in, nor roped myself and kin to the live oak, nor breathed the wreck of mourning like the dead on Judgment Day. Just as I never lived in the big house, in suffocating cells suffused with mayhem and self-loathing, nor ancestral manse with all the unused rooms and huddled sheds so crammed with the crap of dead generations that generations of heirs could never get to the bottom of it, could never conceive that. Although I never lived there, or in any other house, I carted them all around like the layers of the great pearl, or the endless mythic shells that undergird the fabulous elephant, that neither holds up the universe, nor stands on tortoises, 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 all the way down to the rec room of that house I never lived in. And that's from issue 9 of the completely amazing Dark Mountain Press's literary journal, completely packed with cracking stuff. God, I enjoy that every time I read it.